Having written books such as Defining the Enemy and Teaching Defiance, it's no surprise that Michael Newman advocates a passionate and politically positioned role for adult educators. If we're educating to bring about social change, he argues we must deal with strong emotions, such as anger, hate, and love. He also maintains we must acknowledge tensions in our beliefs. We may recoil from violence, but we can't deny that sometimes it works to bring about change for the better. Far from being a firebrand, Newman believes that these strong emotions are the basis of a moral and principled approach to how we go about our role in activist and union education. He explored these ideas in a talk to union educators at the 2009 Trans-Tasman Union Educators Conference in a large, echoey room at Unions New South Wales, Sydney.
I'm going to talk about strong emotions. And I touched upon some of them this morning. Anger, hate, and love as well, if we must. And I talked myself into a philosophical and political corner as well, because I said I didn't approve of violence. I'm not in favour of violence, God help me. My brief encounter with it, you know, means I would never want anything to do with violence. And yet there is this conundrum that in political action, very often it is only when the action is pushed to the point of violence that the authorities take any notice. So there's a horrible kind of problem there. My partner is French, and I watched the French with interest. In 2006, there was a change in the industrial relations laws under the prime ministership of de Villepin, and Chirac was president. And the French went into the streets. An amazing alliance of people, the fringe dwellers from the bidonville and the great big HLM, the big sort of council housing commission stuff. So the marginal went into the street, and the traditional working class represented by the Communist Party went into the street alongside them. And so did the middle class, who were thinkers and activists and did not like the law. And they went into the streets, but in that amazing French way, they turned cars over and set a light to them and had these vicious battles with the authorities. And I always hate that because, you know, it's not the police's fault. Somehow, this is April 2006, somehow with that sort of peculiar French genius, no one was killed. But there was a hell of a lot of damage, and there was a hell of a lot of violence, and people were injured. But it's interesting that when it reached that level, Chirac called de Villepin in and said, "Well, look, my dear fellow, I have listened to the people, and they don't like your law." And the industrial relations reform legislation was repealed. I'm sitting there in Paris thinking, wow, you know, this raises a whole lot of questions. Well, I shall try and talk my way out of this conundrum that I don't approve of violence, but I am worried about the pragmatic use of it. And I'm going to talk about the emotions of dismay, anger, hate, and love. The first emotion I want to talk about is dismay. You're in a friend's house, and they leave the room for a moment, and it's tiled floor, and they've left you holding one of their really valuable china plates, and by some horrible mistake you drop it and it smashes on the tiles, and you are staring at this plate, And the emotion you experience is dismay. And dismay is a complex and interesting emotion because there are two immediate desires when you experience dismay. One is to get the hell out. There's a back door. You could get out the back door down the side of the garden and be gone. There's a bus stop at the corner and you're away. Or the second one is to do something about it, to flee or to do something about it. I was in South Africa in 1996 and went to see a wonderful comrade called Chris Bonner, who at that stage was the education officer of the Chemical Workers Union. And we sat talking, and as we spent an afternoon talking about this, that and the other and the dark days of apartheid and so on, and I could see that she was growing kind of upset and uneasy, and I said, sort of, what's wrong? And she said, well, you know, when Mandela walked free and then when he was elected president and the ANC government came into place just 2 years ago, I expected changes for the good, but I am sitting here in dismay because actually I am yearning for the old days. I'm having to confront the fact that I want to return to the days of apartheid when the issues were clear, the battle lines were drawn. And now I'm not experiencing all the promise that I expected. I am holding in my hands newspaper on the Sunday morning after the election, when the Labour Party was re-elected after 13 years or whatever it was in the wilderness. But this morning I heard dismay in the voice of the speaker talking about the fact that the intervention is still in place in the Northern Territory. So dismay is an oddly powerful emotion. It carries shock and surprise and a desire to flee or a desire to do something. If you capture people at a moment of dismay and you're activist educators, perhaps you have the opportunity to stop people fleeing and motivate people to action. I want to talk about anger. It's very important when we talk about anger to make a distinction between anger and rage. Rage is a glorious, ecstatic moment in which you abandon all control and your only desire is to in some way impinge upon the environment, tear a door off its hinges, smash your car. It's ecstatic, but it's highly damaging and dangerous. So we need to understand, if we talk about anger, that we're making a distinction between anger and rage. Rage is like an on-off switch. It just goes on and we're mad. We're in ecstasy, but we're completely mad. And it can be switched off, hopefully. Anger is like a dimmer switch. Right? We can be irked. And then we can be marginally pissed off. And then we can be bloody annoyed. And then we can be furious. And then we can be really angry. And so it's like a dimmer switch. We can turn it up and we can turn it down. And if we're educators, then perhaps this is something that we can engage in and work with a group of people on. And I would think I was talking absolute nonsense if I didn't have the wonderful example of an old mate of mine called Jane Thompson. Jane Thompson is a fantastic educator. English, lives in England, wrote a totally brilliant book in 1983 called Learning Liberation, Women's Response to Men's Education, which is a tremendous feminist, a tremendous feminist text, but it's also a brilliant educational text to be read by anyone. She set up a Second Chance for Women course in the late 70s and through the 80s into the 90s out of Southampton University, but not held at the university, held in an old disused school. She made two arbitrary decisions, one that she would take only working class people, and the second was she would take only working class women. And it was a sort of essentially a re-entry or a retaking of education for people who'd missed out on education. She used, totally academic methods, reading of quite complex texts, detailed discussion, writing. In the morning, the women would meet some 15 or 20, and they would discuss themes like health, because all of them had been patients, all of them had had to go to the doctor, some of them might work in the laundry of the local hospital, some of them might work as cleaners of clinics or in the hospital. So they all had an understanding of health, and she would look at the issues of health, and this of course would take them into looking at issues of government policy, and it would take them into looking at issues of women's health and the degree to which women had the same access to health as men did, actually. Or she would use a theme like space, because there were spaces in Southampton where women couldn't go, parks after night, certain areas of pubs. And if you looked at the issue of space, you then had to look at the issues of design, and you had to look again at the issues of policy and politics, and you had to look at the issues of architecture, local government. So she would, during the course of a year, by taking extraordinary themes like this and getting these women to read and read, take them and introduce them into study and into the sort of pursuit of knowledge. And she would call it the reclaiming of knowledge, because she would be putting women back into the issue of space, or she would be putting women back into health, or women, of course, back into history, from which you women have been excluded for most of the time. In the afternoon, she would get them to write. Not creative writing, but they might use the forms of poetry and short story, but to write about their own experiences, about being treated as second-class citizens, about being done down by bureaucracies, about being mistreated, about being abused. And these pieces of writing would be fed back into the morning, and it was a rich and powerful kind of education. And Jane wrote this: growth through anger, focused with precision, can be a powerful source of energy, serving progress and change. Anger, expressed and translated into actions in the service of women's visions and women's futures, can be a liberating and strengthening act of clarification. For it is in the painful process of this translation that we identify who are our genuine allies and who are our enemies. Tremendous stuff. Growth through anger, focused with precision. So, I'll have a break, and you might talk to yourselves about examples of anger amongst your members that could be focused with precision. I want to say one more thing. This is not an anger workshop held at a pleasant hotel where we go into a room and beat mattresses or walk in the bush and shriek. No, this is cold and calculated and studied and knowledgeable, and it is anger focused with precision. Can you use that with your members? So I've got hate and love to do. Knock them over in a couple of minutes. So first off, let me talk about hate. I mean, people get really upset when you talk about hate or hatred. And I have had the experience of somebody stand up in the middle of a hall in Minneapolis, actually. Although I don't think that's important. But anyway, Minneapolis. This fellow stood up and he said, "I can't believe I'm hearing this." And then he walked out. It sort of dampened my presentation a bit. And I can't understand that. And I can't understand why you can't talk about hate, because hate is natural. And as I said this morning, I mean, there would be, you know, it would be unnatural not to hate some people, and it would be unnatural not to hate some things. And I was watching the television. I think I just sort of kind of was almost zapping. I mean, I turned the television on. I didn't think to watch it, but there was Nelson Mandela. This is some years ago. He's being interviewed, and he was asked what he felt about the people he was struggling against before he was put on Robben Island, you know, before the 1964 Rivonia trial. And he looked at the interviewer and he said, without hesitation and very simply, "I hated them." And I'm thinking, oh, well, no, you know, fair enough. Nelson Mandela can hate people. That's kind of, that gives me a bit. My mother, I don't want to embarrass you about talking about my family, but, you know, but there you are. My mother was what we describe in Australia as a good hater. I just tremendous. When she started going, it was fantastic. And all the rest of us in the family, we would all sort of quieten and sit small and so on. We weren't the subject of the hatred, but, you know, it would be unwise to drop a comment in, you know. You know, I was talking about this with my brother and sister. I mean, you know, I'm 70 now, and my brother and sister are older. I was talking about it with my brother and sister, and my sister was laughing away and saying, "Too right," and telling others. Well, my brother was sitting there totally mystified. He'd repressed it entirely. He'd forgotten, you know, and until then I'd not believed in this, you know, false memory stuff, but, you know, anyway, but I digress. I think hate is natural. All downhill from now on. Just got to deal with love, and then we're out and running. Jane Thompson, whom I love, she used a process by which she got each woman to affirm her identity. These were working class women who'd not had much of a chance. She got each woman to affirm her identity and to do it in the company of other women. And then by adding in a feminist analysis, getting them to affirm their identity conceptually in solidarity with every woman on the planet. I mean, you've got to just be in awe of that. Get each woman to affirm her identity, but to do it in the company of other women. And then, by applying a feminist analysis conceptually in solidarity with every woman on the planet. And I can suggest to my Indigenous educator friends, you could get a group of Aboriginal people together and you could follow a process. I don't mind how you do it, but you could follow a process in which you got each individual Indigenous person to affirm her or his identity, but to do so in the company of other Indigenous people. And then by locating that affirmation in a history of the Aboriginal people's struggle in the context of the Indigenous people's struggles across the world, conceptually with every Indigenous person on the face of the planet. And I could talk to my worker education friends, but you're actually in front of me, and I could say, well, I don't care how you do it, but you could use a process in which you got each working person, each union member, to affirm her or his identity, but to do it in the company of other unionists. And then by applying, well, in my case it would be a socialist leaning on Marxist analysis, conceptually in solidarity with every working person on the face of the planet. Now listen, Jane Thompson comes up with that kind of formula because she loves the people she works with, whether they're women in war-ravaged Belfast, or women in Southampton, or women in South Africa, various places that she's worked. So I want to talk about love. And I've talked about hate, and I don't want to balance hate out with love. How ridiculous, because you would have them cancel each other out. I want to keep, for both hate and love, I want to keep them separate so that each of these amazing emotions retains its own exigent moral force. I'd best do this by telling a story which I've told a lot of times, so I apologise to those of you who heard it before or maybe have read it. But in that time when I was in South Africa in 1996, I started off in Johannesburg and spent a little bit of time with COSATU. And I ran into the education officer of the Metalworkers Union of South Africa, and I went to some courses that he ran. And in a bar afterwards, he told me about a character called Rick Turner. I half listened, I heard the name Rick Turner. I moved on to Durban and was located in the University of KwaZulu-Natal for 3 or 4 weeks. And I was staying at the place, the house of Gillian Nicholson, who's visited Australia, a union educator. And she had a centre called Trade Union Research Centre at at University of KwaZulu-Natal. And Gillian mentioned Rick Turner's name. My ears picked up, you know, this fellow's name. And then on the first day I was crossing the campus to find the sort of broom closet in which the Trade Union Research Centre was located, there was a building, and it was the Rick Turner building. And sort of during my time there, people would talk to me about Rick Turner, and it was as if he was there, or maybe had been there last week. That he just died maybe 3 or 4 days ago. And I remember some fellow that I had nothing much to do with. We'd fallen into conversation on the campus at one of the little food stalls. And he said, I've got Rick's lecture notes on Marxism or something. Would you like to see them? So I mean, it was this uncanny sort of sense that Turner was just around the corner somewhere. So obviously I asked questions, tried to find out a bit more about Turner. And he had he'd been born in 1939, so kind of same age as me, and he had studied engineering, but at the end of his engineering degree, he didn't sort of want to be an engineer, and he wanted to study philosophy, so he did a degree in philosophy. And at the end of his degree in philosophy, he decided he'd like to study in the Sorbonne under the remnants of the existentialists. I mentioned the existentialists this morning. Jean-Paul Sartre was still alive. Sadly, Albert Camus had killed himself in a car crash in 1960. But anyway, Turner had to learn French from scratch, went off and did a degree in France. And then most sort of white South Africans at that time who could have asked for a job anywhere, he was a brilliant philosopher, he decided to go back and teach in the philosophy department at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. In 1968, with students rioting across the world, students came to Rick and said, should we be doing something here? And Rick Turner told them, no, go away and just read. So he was no activist. In 73, the South African government set up the South African Council of Churches, would you believe it, around about 1970, I'm getting my dates wrong, set up a commission into how you could be a Christian under apartheid. I mean, interesting stuff, this. And they travelled the country getting evidence, and they wrote a report which has sunk like a lead balloon. It doesn't exist anywhere. And they employed Rick Turner, who was an atheist, but they employed him as a research officer. And from his research papers, Turner wrote a book which was published in 1973 called The Eye of the Needle. And Gillian Nicholson, my mate, lent me the book and I read it. And I can't tell you how amazing this book is. It's of its age. You need to read it, understanding the times. But Turner is a philosopher and he mounts a philosophical attack on apartheid. And he uses all sorts of arguments. He uses conventional philosophical logical arguments. He uses common sense. He uses argument via negativa, in which he sets up an argument to knock it down. He uses every possible method of reasoning. So for just that reason, it's a gem of a book to read. He rewrites South African history. He re-argues South African history. The thugs, the violent whites, and the story that have been repressed, he tells. He argues for a form of economic democracy. An economic democracy will start in the workplace, and it will start with the unions. And this book was published in 73, and shortly after 73, in the latter part of the 70s, the black unions grow. They form themselves. They become enormous. The white apartheid government is not watching, and before they know it, the miners have more than 1 million members, and you can't actually repress an organisation with 1 million members. The unions, the black unions, grow. Bobby Murray, education officer of the metal workers, told me that it was because of Turner's book. A non-activist writes this book. He is called before a court to give witness in 1973, and he goes before the court saying, I've done nothing wrong, and gives evidence. But the court actually really is a kangaroo court to charge him. And as he steps down from the witness box, he is banned for 5 years. Banning in those days in apartheid South Africa meant that you couldn't go to a workplace, you couldn't meet more than one person at a time, you couldn't go to a shopping centre. You maybe, just possibly, could go down to the corner shop to buy a packet of cigarettes if you were by yourself. The university, God bless them, continues paying him. Turner closes in on himself and for 5 years writes a long and never yet published examination of the philosophy of Jean-Paul Sartre. So this is not your traditional activist. In 1978, 2 or 3 months before his 5 years are up, in the evening he goes to his front door to answer a knock on the door. There is a lead-lined window on either side of the door, and he puts his head to the glass to see who's there, and he is shot through the temple and dies immediately. It is accepted that it was the security forces that assassinated Rick Turner, because Rick Turner, more than anyone else in South Africa at the time, had the power and the thinking and the critical mind to bring together the people who were training as guerrillas in the border company countries right across the political spectrum to the liberal members of parliament. And he was perceived to be a massive threat. And I wanted a copy of the book for me to take home. And I went looking for it. And I rang round and I visited bookshops. And I found in a funny little suburb in Durban a bookshop that said they had it. And I went to the bookshop and walk through this one of those crusty bookshops that you find anywhere in the world selling Len Dayton novels and things. And I asked for the Turner book. Yeah, we've got it. And the guy who served me was black, and he went and he got the book and came back to the counter, and the white guy in the shop, an older man, said, "I'll wrap it." And the black man stood next to him, and I stood on the other side of the counter, and the white man wrapped the book tenderly. And when it was completely wrapped, beautifully wrapped, he handed it to me and he said, "I was at Rick's funeral." And again, I had this uncanny feeling that Turner had died just yesterday. So, what am I trying to say here? Turner made choices and took action and defied a hateful regime and lost his life as a result. Turner made choices, took action, defied a hateful regime, and was loved for the choices he made and the action he took. So now I have, it's not particularly foolproof and it wouldn't stand up to close analysis, but now I have my moral guide. Hate for the hateful should be our motivating force. Love from the people we respect should be our goal, our guide, and our source of moral authority. Whose love would I want to earn each time I made a choice? Well, I never met him, but Nelson Mandela would be one, I think. So that's the end of my talk, but you might talk amongst yourselves as I stagger towards the bar of examples of people whose love you would like to earn in your work as union educators. So thanks very much.
You've been listening to Michael Newman speaking at the 2009 Trans-Tasman Union Educators Conference, organised by the Australian Council of Trade Unions and the New Zealand Council of Trade Unions. More information on Michael and downloads of three of his books can be found at www.michaelnewman.info. His latest book, available for sale, is Teaching Defiance. This podcast was recorded and produced by Chris Walker. The music is by Wasaru. And many thanks to Michael Newman for agreeing to this recording.